Since the dawn of civilization, spies of every nation and culture have worked to infiltrate their adversaries and glean the information that will give their side the advantage. The stakes are sky high, the strategies varied and imaginative, and the ultimate sign of success is that no one ever even knew you were there. In each episode, we will explore the moral and ethical gray zones of espionage, where treachery and betrayal go hand in hand with cunning and courage. This is the Spycraft 101 podcast. Welcome to your clandestine classroom. This is episode number 131 of the Spycraft 101 podcast. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Alan McPherson. Alan is a historian of U.S. foreign relations at Temple University and the director of the Center for the Study of Force and Diplomacy. He received his PhD in history from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and his MA in history from San Francisco State University. He has also published 11 books and dozens of articles on U.S. foreign relations, particularly regarding Latin America. I invited Alan onto the podcast to discuss his book, Ghosts of Sheridan Circle: How a Washington Assassination Brought Pinochet's Terror State to Justice. It's a story which culminates in a bombing in Washington, D.C. in September 1976, which took the lives of two people and wounded a third. The perpetrators were linked to the government of General Augusto Pinochet and to the Central Intelligence Agency as well. But before we dive into this story, I want to say a big thank you to everyone listening who is also supporting me on Patreon, including Jesse G. and Mason S. Your monthly contributions there help me keep this podcast going week in and week out. As a way of thanking my patrons, I offer a lot of great freebies and promotions, including free and discounted books and products from the Spycraft 101 store. Patrons also get exclusive access to long-form articles of mine that aren't available anywhere else. If you haven't signed up for my Patreon yet, but you want to, just click the link in the show notes on whatever podcast platform you're listening to right now. Alan, thank you for joining me today.
My pleasure.
Great. As soon as I found your book, which was not that long ago, I knew that this was a story my listeners absolutely had to hear. So I'm glad that they can hear it directly from you.
Oh, me too. It's a fascinating story.
It certainly is. So what is it specifically that led you to write about this to begin with?
Well, I mean, I studied broadly sort of U.S. Latin American relations. I was interested in doing something on the Reagan years, and I knew vaguely about this assassination that takes place really at the end of the Ford presidency in 1976. But what I realized researching it is that it really also, it remains an issue in the late 70s and the 80s and even in the 90s. And so throughout sort of the Reagan years, because it's such a diplomatic problem between the United States and Chile. And so I really thought, you know, the rest of the story after the assassination has not been completely told. And so that was my motivation for writing this book.
Okay. Yeah. Understandable. And that was something that I was not aware of. I learned about the bombing itself probably a little over a year ago, just in some related research. But like you said, I didn't know anything really about the years long repercussions of that and the changes in Chile and in relations with the U.S. and everything. And that was quite a story in and of itself, which, you know, you covered, I'm assuming, just about for the first time anywhere. So can we start? We want to talk about the victim of the bombing is Orlando Letelier. Can you talk about him, his early life and his career, what led him to Washington in the first place?
Sure. Letelier is essentially an economist, but a politician also. And he, you know, grows up in Chile from a sort of pretty comfortable family, gets really interested in the issue of copper, which is Chile's biggest export. It's the export that brings all these sort of big foreign corporations to Chile. And so if you're sort of an economic nationalist, right, it's a thing you're going to keep an eye on. And so he starts really thinking about how Chile is being exploited by foreign corporations through copper, goes to work in Venezuela for a while, but also basically in the 50s, he befriends Salvador Allende, who will eventually become president. But because he's friends with Allende, he loses his job in the government, so he has to leave to get a job. So he ends up in Venezuela, and then eventually in 1960, he ends up in Washington, D.C., working for a relatively new outfit called the Inter-American Development Bank. Right. So a lot of economists from throughout Latin America are gathered there. They can essentially work in Spanish, and they're often working on these problems of sort of, you know, perceived economic exploitation between the United States and Latin America. And so he really sort of starts growing this conscience, and he becomes essentially a socialist also.
Hmm. Okay. So he does not have a government position initially when he's here in the U.S. Does that come later in that case, his relationship with Allende?
That's exactly right. I mean, you know, the IADB is sort of this multinational thing, so you could call it a government position, right? It's paid for by all the big governments. However, yes, he's not working for the Chilean government because Allende is not in power. So what, you know, but he's there for a solid 10 years. And so when Allende does become president in 1970, he starts thinking, you know, who are the Chileans in Washington, D.C., who are respected, who can speak English, who are, you know, hopefully already there. And he checks all those boxes. And so he essentially goes from living in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. to, in 1970, living in the ambassador's residence in Washington itself.
Hmm. Okay, I see. And he was like an effective kind of guy, even with the bank. Was he already making the kind of connections that would be helpful to Allende's new government in that case?
Oh, yes. I mean, you know, he wasn't a very high profile person. He's an economist at a, you know, at a big bank, but he's, I mean, a measure of how sort of important he is that the CIA starts keeping a file on him in 1960, essentially as soon as he moves to Washington, D.C. Now, that might just mean that the CIA keeps tabs on every foreigner working in D.C. at the time, but there's a file on him. And they actually say, you know, his reputation is quite positive. You know, he's earned his promotions. He's a hard worker. People like him. They call him socially pleasant. They like his wife also. And so he sort of becomes part of this, you know, vast group of people in Washington, D.C. who come in and out of the city, and they're very cosmopolitan. They work on international or national matters. And so, you know, I think he feels very comfortable. And he also has four children with his wife, and she essentially also, you know, gets to know the city. Their children are sort of half Chilean, half American. Every summer they go spend the summer back in Chile. But, you know, they all grow up in sort of the schools in and around Washington, D.C. And so they're really sort of half Chilean, half American.
Okay, I see. Was this like a very big or a very difficult transition for him and the family, for him to move from this financial position to like a diplomatic role? I mean, it seems like he was a natural fit for it, but there must have been, you know, something of a big change for them, I would imagine.
I mean, there's some adjustments. Obviously, they moved to a nicer house, right? They're in the ambassador's residence. I've been there. And it's a beautiful big place. I think in terms of his job, obviously, he's got to deal directly now with the U.S. government on a regular basis, right? I mean, he'll meet people like Henry Kissinger. I don't think he ever meets Nixon, maybe only to sort of give over his, present his credentials as the ambassador. And in fact, he's liked by Kissinger, at least that's what Kissinger says, right? That he likes him. But at the same time, obviously, 1970 to 1973 is a very, very fraught time between the United States and Chile. He is not only the ambassador, but he's the representative of a socialist party. You know, he's a socialist like Allende. They come into power under very tricky circumstances where the United States itself tries to prevent the ascension to power of the man who won the most votes. And so the United States wants to essentially sort of strangle, you know, democracy in its cradle, because democracy in Chile has elevated a socialist to the presidency. And so it's a difficult relationship. And it gets even more difficult because the United States is essentially sabotaging the Chilean economy, Chilean politics, through all sorts of sort of CIA shenanigans in those 3 years. The CIA spends millions of dollars to trying to sort of essentially undermine the rule of this socialist Democrat. And this is what Letelier as ambassador has to negotiate. I mean, the big thing that his president does is he wants to nationalize the copper companies, and these are mostly American copper companies. And so the United States government starts really clamping down on Chile, cutting off any kind of international aid it might be getting, cutting off loans. And so he's trying to be a diplomat to basically say, we're not attacking the United States. We're just trying to sort of gain control over our natural resources. You know, Chile is also at the same time opening up sort of normal relations with socialist countries like the Soviet Union, like Cuba. And that is not pleasing the Nixon administration either. And so it's a very difficult time for Letelier, but, you know, he takes the job and he knows this is how it's going to be.
Okay. Yeah. He's caught in a tough position there. No question about it. And if I'm not mistaken, Allende was the first democratically elected socialist leader in Latin America to that point, right? Like there had obviously been some revolutions and coups and that sort of thing, but he was the first one elected by the people, wasn't he?
That's right. I mean, Chile had a long tradition of peaceful elections. You know, there had been a socialist revolution in Cuba in 1959. Many in the United States looked at Chile and they said, well, it's another Cuba, but it really wasn't. Because, you know, the Chileans called this La Vía Chilena or the Chilean Way. And the Chilean way meant we're going to get to socialism, but we'll do it the democratic way. We'll get into power. We'll change the economics of the country. People will reelect us and then we'll just sort of keep going like this. So it's certainly wishful thinking, but it's a plan that is hard to oppose in the open. But what's really important here is that people like Kissinger and Nixon feel that Chile is a great threat to the United States precisely because it is aiming for a socialist regime through elections. And if Chile is allowed to succeed, right, it's not that Chile itself is particularly important, but as a symbol of sort of democratic socialism, it is a very dangerous symbol because then you could have this reproduced throughout Latin America, throughout Africa, Asia, Europe, where people would say, well, Chile's done it and the United States didn't stop it. So therefore, we should be able to elect a socialist party also and oppose, you know, imperialism and so on. And so Chile really is a threat to the United States in the eyes of the United States government.
Yeah. We don't have much of a pretext for intervention when it's what the people want. And they've shown it at the ballot box. That's for certain. So I understand that this situation did not last very long, right? Approximately 3 years or so Allende was in power.
That's right. And it ends famously on September 11th, 1973, when General Augusto Pinochet, along with other military leaders, stage a coup. So at this point, there's been 3 years of just utter turmoil in Chile. Right. A lot of it has been fomented by the United States. Right. They're sort of placing articles in newspapers. They're bribing politicians. They're sort of prodding the truckers to go on strike, the women to go on, you know, to do demonstrations. And so anywhere they can sort of rev up the discontent, they're going to do so. Now, that's not blaming entirely the United States for the troubles of Chile. The Chileans themselves are making mistakes. Allende is trying to probably move too fast towards sort of a socialized economy. But the result is that there is increasingly unhappiness in the armed forces in Chile. There's always been people who hated Allende. And now they are, by 1973, they are determined that, you know, he's the devil, that he is going to sort of end Chilean democracy for good, that he's going to sort of end Christianity in Chile. And they see him as sort of this real sort of tool of evil. And they say, you know, they're the ones who are going to terrorize Chileans, and therefore we need to terrorize them and create a coup which will sort of spread this terror and sort of wash away this evil once and for all. And so it's a very ideological coup.
Okay. Was this coup, I understand that things had changed. I think you mentioned in the book, like there's runaway inflation by that point in the country. I mean, was there popular support after a 3 year period for this coup, or was this kind of like out of nowhere, just a cabal of motivated officers?
Yeah, no, there's definitely popular support for the coup. Like I said, there are problems in the economy. Now, interestingly, there is a sort of midterm election halfway through these 3 years, and the socialists actually pick up more seats, or at least a greater proportion of the vote. So they're also picking up adherents, right? There's people who are saying, hey, this is actually not bad. You know, he's helping the poor, he's helping indigenous folks, and so on. And so he's becoming more popular, but you have to remember that when he won in 1970, he only had 36% of the vote. That was more than any other candidate, but it was still a very small plurality. And so he was never overwhelmingly popular, right? So he goes from 36 to something like 42, 43. So still you've got the majority of Chileans voting against the socialists. And so then you have sort of the dynamics that you often have in a coup or in a totalitarian society where the coup plotters start spreading lies, right? And they start essentially spreading innuendo about how terrible Allende was, and he was trying to, you know, spread terrorism and steal your babies. I mean, you name the lie, it's out there. You know, he's going to get us invaded by Cuba or this, or the, you know, the Soviets. And none of that is true. But once people start disappearing, right, and there's thousands and thousands who start disappearing at the coup, then for a lot of very conservative people, and Chile is a pretty conservative country, they start thinking, well, these disappeared people, maybe they don't deserve death, but they must have done something, right? That's how you start thinking when you live in a totalitarian society that prevents, you know, information and transparency, is that you start thinking there must have been a huge plot, right? And therefore this coup is justified. And what's also at sort of the front of the rhetoric of the coup is that this is temporary. We're just going to sort of pacify Chile, get rid of the communists. It's going to last a year, maybe two. I mean, it's not clear what the timeline is, but in their minds, they're saving democracy, right? They're not imposing totalitarianism. And essentially they're saying, you know, give us a little bit of time here. We need to be tough, but eventually we're going to clear up all this evil and we'll come back to democracy.
Okay. That's a interesting way of selling it to the public, I guess. Right. So these people that disappeared, were they all being imprisoned? Were they being killed by that point? I know that many were killed ultimately.
Oh, yes. I mean, they're killed very quickly. You know, the majority are killed within the first maybe 3 months of this 17-year dictatorship, or at least in the first year. And they'll total about 3,000, 3,200 people will get killed. But many thousands more are imprisoned. Many of those are tortured in prison. And of course, there's hundreds of thousands who leave Chile, right? And the Letelieres will eventually be, you know, a family that leaves Chile. And so, you know, when you spread terror, you don't necessarily need to kill a lot of people, right? You need to sort of spread terror, right? So people need to be so afraid that they will stop any kind of activities against you and usually fade into the background, or they will leave the country. And that's what Pinochet, who becomes the head of this government very quickly, is very good at sort of spreading the sense that there is no resistance to the Pinochet government whatsoever.
Well, so what happens to Letelier's family in the U.S. at that time? I mean, he must have some sort of target on his back at that point, even if he's in the U.S.
Well, it's actually worse than that, because he's not in the U.S. He's in Chile on the day of the coup. So for most of the 3 years, he is ambassador. But then around the summer of 1973, about 3 months before the coup, you know, Allende, the president, calls him up and says, listen, there's a lot of trouble here. Please come back and be the Minister of Foreign Relations, right? Which is our Secretary of State. And so he does that. And in fact, the Chileans now, the book is out in Chile in Spanish, and they talk of him much more as the ex-canciller, right? The ex-Minister of Foreign Relations. That's how they know him, even though he was a much longer time ambassador. And then in the 9 days before the coup, he gets named Minister of Defense. So now he's directly in charge of people like Pinochet. And Pinochet is the head of the army. So Pinochet is working with them, right, and sees him almost every day. It's a very strange relationship. I mean, Pinochet is carrying his briefcase. He's very obsequious towards, you know, his minister. So his whole family has come back to Santiago. And so they're all living in town. The boys are all teenagers. And so the day of is very dramatic. So he goes to sleep at something like 2-3 in the morning the day before, gets woken up at about 5 by basically somebody calling him and saying, there are some very worrisome troop movements, right? They've taken over one town, there's tanks moving, the Navy has revolted. And he calls up one of his top generals who he suspects might be part of the coup. And the general basically says, oh, no, don't worry, Mr. Minister. These are all exercises. There's no coup whatsoever. And then he holds the phone up to his wife, Isabel, and he says, listen to the voice of a traitor. You know, he knows guy's lying to him, and he knows that he just doesn't want the minister to stop the coup. So immediately they call up Allende, and Allende says, yes, there's a coup going on. So come downtown as fast as you can. Come to your offices, try to get control over this. Turns out they've already lost control. The coup is already advancing. But he walks into the Ministry of Foreign Relations, which is across the street from the palace of the presidency. And as soon as he's in there, somebody puts a rifle to his back and says, you know, keep moving. And it turns out it's essentially his bodyguard, right? So everybody essentially has turned against him. So he's imprisoned for a few days in and around Santiago, and he hears people getting tortured. It's really awful. He's blindfolded for much of it. Eventually, he gets put on a plane, and he sort of has a feeling, you know, I know where I'm going. And he's exactly right. He ends up at Dawson Island, right? It's got this British name, and it's way down close to the Antarctic. There's a little island out there, and there essentially are concentration camps, right? And he and many other top officials of the Allende government, right? Other ministers are all living in these little shacks surrounded by barbed wire and armed guards. And he stayed there for almost a year. So it's quite awful. It's very cold, right? There's absolutely no chance of escape. And meanwhile, his wife is essentially under house arrest, I think for a month or 2 months. She's under house arrest in Santiago. You know, nobody wants to talk to them anymore, because if you talk to them, then you're branded as sort of an enemy of the new military regime. And so they lose a lot of their friends. You know, the boys obviously are very unhappy. The house arrest essentially ends. And then she tries for that whole year to just see her husband to make sure that he's alive. Eventually, she does get news from him that he and the others are alive. But it takes a whole year to get him out of that concentration camp. And he goes to another, essentially another prison closer to Santiago. But there seems to be no hope of getting him out for that whole year from 1973 to late 1974.
So he was released ultimately in the end. Was there a reason that he was not among the 3,000 plus that were killed? Was he too high profile, or was he not considered a threat? Or,
you know, we don't know exactly how Pinochet's thinking, but what happens is that Letelier had been in Venezuela briefly, and he was friends with a powerful person in Venezuela. I think he was the governor of the province of Caracas or something like that. And this guy essentially starts making phone calls, right? And says, you know, we're an important trade partner. You're holding people who haven't done anything. You haven't charged them with anything, right? They're not on trial for anything. So we ask that you let them go. And he's let go as part of this sort of show of magnanimity, right, by the Pinochet government. You know, Pinochet was pretty awful, but he wants the sort of the world to know that, you know, Chile is slowly going back to democracy. It's, you know, it's privatizing its economy. It's open for business again. And so I think that's the general sense that he wants to give, is that, you know, we're going to just get rid of these enemies of the country, but, you know, we're not going to kill them because they, you know, they didn't rise up violently against us, and so on and so forth. And so, Letelier then takes his family and ends up in Washington, D.C. As essentially a private citizen.
Okay. I see. So he's a little bit adrift in that case. Is he like an exile? Like if he goes back, he'll be in danger again? Or
Yeah. I mean, he retains his citizenship, but I mean, he's basically told directly, you know, personally by Pinochet. Pinochet says, I'm letting you go, but if you do anything, right, any activities whatsoever against my government, you will regret it, right? The threat is very vague, but, you know, Letelier gets the message. But Letelier is a very determined individual. I mean, he's really a patriot. You know, you might not necessarily agree with his politics, but nobody says that he's not a patriot. And so he basically says, these threats cannot stop me from what I need to do, which is to try to liberate Chile, right, from this dictatorship. And so he accepts a job in Washington, D.C. with the Institute of Policy Studies. So it's a big sort of leftist think tank. And they have a few of these sort of foreigners and exiles who work for them. So he's going to do all sorts of activities, but one of them he's going to do is keep on denouncing the Pinochet government and all of the sort of economic reforms that it's undertaking, that which are really radically privatizing that country.
Okay. So how effective is IPS? Like, do they come back up on Pinochet's radar at some point? I mean, is he really able to, you know, stir up some fervor outside of Chile against the Pinochet regime?
Yeah. IPS itself is not completely devoted to this, right? It does all sorts of things throughout the world. It does things throughout Latin America. On Chile, there's really just Letelier and a few aides who are sort of working on this on almost full-time basis. So he does a lot of sort of propaganda type stuff, like write editorials for newspapers and magazines and sort of explain the sort of problem that is Chile. He tries to help the sort of hundreds of thousands of exiles in the United States, Canada, other places in Latin America who would like to, if not return to Chile, at least be treated as, you know, political refugees. So there's all sorts of issues to be worked on, but he does do a few things to try to directly sort of hurt the Pinochet regime. It's hard to do, right? He doesn't have much of a budget. It's really essentially just him and a very small bureaucracy. But one thing he's able to do is get the Longshoremen's Association of the Netherlands to threaten to boycott a major Netherlands corporation. And in doing so, he gets that corporation to cancel a huge contract it was going to sign with Pinochet. It was something like $62 million. So just this one guy, right, working as a private individual in Washington is hurting Pinochet to the tune of $62 million, right? None of this is illegal. None of this is violent. It's peaceful, right, boycotting, but he's very effective. And in a more general sense, he's effective in that he's sort of a soft socialist, right? He's never done anything violent. He's never advocated violence. He's very gentlemanly. So the other Chileans who are not socialist, but who have also been kicked out of the country, they like him. They can talk to him, right? They might be living in Paris or Rome or maybe somewhere else in the States or, you know, in Mexico. And he has a lot of friends. And so part of what happens, and again, I can't read Pinochet's mind, but I think Pinochet is starting to fear that Letelier is somewhere in the middle of sort of organizing a government in exile, right? A government that is preparing to sort of hit him, overthrow him, and then come back and take control of Chile. None of that is true. They're just sort of helping each other out with boycotts and that sort of thing. But I think he starts getting really paranoid. Plus, he doesn't like the fact that Letelier has been effective on the economic front.
I see. So how is the Pinochet regime like viewed by the U.S. government at this time? Like, have they established good relations with us overall? I mean, it's viewed pretty negatively now, but how was it at the time?
I mean, at the time, you know, there's no single view, but I could sort of, you know, in the U.S. government, and this is sort of the Nixon government, then it's the Ford government. And throughout this time, Henry Kissinger is essentially in charge of foreign policy. There's essentially two views. One is we are entirely 100% on the side of Chile. It saved this country from communism. It saved it from becoming sort of a beachhead for the Soviets in South America. It has sort of, you know, Pinochet has eliminated Chile as an example of how the socialists can sort of sneak into a democratic government. And whatever it needs to do to eliminate that threat forever, including killing thousands of people, we're fine with that. And there are many meetings of Kissinger with Pinochet in which he essentially intimates this, right? He's too smart to say it openly, but he'll say things like, "We know you've got some major problems. You need to take care of it. Do so quickly. We're on your side. You know, we're not going to denounce anything that you feel you need to do against the terrorists." So he'll use those kinds of terms, which is music to the ears of Pinochet. Now, the other part of the U.S. government is basically saying, it's sort of people mostly in the State Department, right? The diplomats, the sort of middle manager folks. And their take is that, you know, we didn't like Allende and we're glad that his government is over, but we would like to do whatever is possible to restrain the violence and the terror of the Pinochet regime, right? So let's denounce his violations of human rights. Let's try to sort of calm him down a little bit. And often they're sort of at loggerheads with Kissinger, who tells them things like, cut out the political science lectures, right? Don't lecture me about human rights. And he never wants to talk about human rights unless, you know, until he's sort of forced to do so by so many people, not in just the State Department, but also in Congress and in private organizations like IPS, right? Human rights is a huge theme right around the time of Chile. And so it becomes difficult for Kissinger to say only, you know, this is all about communism, anti-communism, and, you know, let's kill them all. He's got to be a little bit more subtle than that.
I see. Yeah, this is Letelier's making things a little bit difficult in that case. So meanwhile, this organization, this Intel organization is formed. Can you, and they, you know, have a huge part to play in this whole story. Can you talk about this Colonel Contreras and the organization that he formed?
Yes. So Manuel Contreras is, you know, a career military man. He's actually studied in the United States. He doesn't speak English particularly well, but, you know, he studied sort of counterterrorism, counter-guerrilla stuff. And so as soon as the coup occurs, Pinochet picks him to create this new organization. It will be essentially his secret police. And it's called DINA in its Spanish acronym. And essentially, it's sort of the very evil portion, you know, it's a evil version of the CIA. It's essentially out there to track down as many opponents of the regime as possible, whether they're communists or socialists or Democrats. If they're opposed to the regime, then they deserve to be imprisoned, tortured, killed, and so on. DINA, in its sort of, you know, will be responsible for about 1,200 of the 3,200 deaths in those 17 years. But DINA will actually not last that long. It'll just last a few years, but it does a lot of damage in those 2 years. So Contreras becomes the really bad guy in the eyes of, you know, of a lot of Chileans and a lot of foreigners within a very bad organization, which is the Pinochet government. And so he's sort of the spy master par excellence who has eyes and ears all over Chile. And it's very hard to sort of escape the iron grip of DINA.
Okay. And the other individual I really wanted to ask you about is this American who becomes affiliated with, I guess, even a paid employee of DINA, Michael Townley. Can you talk about how he, as an American citizen, became affiliated with Chilean intelligence?
Yes. I mean, Michael Townley is probably the most odd story in this because he goes to Chile as a child. I think he's in middle school when he first goes there. His father, you know, is an executive for Ford. And they move to a couple of countries, but most of the time is spent in Chile. He learns Spanish. He graduates high school, but he doesn't go to college. And instead, you know, he's scrambling to find some kind of living. It's hard. He sort of fixes machines. He sort of puts together radios. I mean, it's really kind of low-level, blue-collar tech stuff. But it turns out that he can do sort of radio control tech. Right. So if you've got like, you know, like a little radio controlled car or something like that. And so he knows how to do that sort of thing. And so he's pretty good at basic tech. Once Allende is in power, then there begins to be a sort of violent underground against them. They're mostly young people. They set off bombs, right? Some car bombs. There's a few assassinations, but it's mostly sort of, you know, non-lethal stuff. And they encounter him and his wife. He marries a Chilean woman. And they basically say, could you show us how to do things like Molotov cocktails or just, you know, very, very basic bombs? And he starts helping this organization, which is called a Patria y Libertad, you know, a Fatherland and Freedom. So when the coup comes in September 73, Fatherland and Freedom, a lot of those young guys, right, they're sort of college age people, end up in the government. And so DINA identifies Michael Townley as a man who has a lot of advantages for them, for their purposes. So one is that he's got this technical knowledge. He can do the bombs, he can do them radio controlled. That's a very important thing. He can also go to the United States and get the rare parts that you need to make these bombs. And he can go there without having to get a visa, right? He's an American citizen. And so nobody will sort of suspect his movements. He's just an American going back and forth to Chile. And he also speaks English. And so he has all these advantages that your average, you know, Chilean doesn't have. And so essentially he starts being this sort of nodal point of a lot of assassinations of what's called Operation Condor. Operation Condor is this multi-country plot, right, to get several military regimes in South America, right, Argentina, Brazil, Bolivia, so on, Paraguay, and Chile, to sort of help each other chase down each other's enemies, right? So let's say you live in Chile and you're a Marxist and, you know, you're clearly in danger and you end up going to live in Bolivia. And you think you're going to be safe there, the Bolivian government will find you, chase you down, and either kill you or, you know, exile you back into Chile, where they'll take care of you. And so Operation Condor becomes this mostly inter-South American regime of terror. But Contreras and others start thinking, you know, there are some Chilean, you know, enemies of the nation, such as Letelier, who are operating from outside of our countries. And so we should go assassinate them too, right? That means if you're in Paris or in, you know, Toronto or New York or in Washington, D.C., they need to know that they're not safe, right? If they act against us, they're also not safe. And so that's how he becomes targeted. It's part of Operation Condor.
Oh, man. That is, I guess there are many regimes all over the world that are, you know, a terror for the people within their borders, but it is a big, big step to go to another continent, send your operatives to another continent and take out people that haven't set foot in the country in years. And of course it happens. We know it happens a lot, but that is a really big move. And they, at least to a certain extent, they pulled it off. Also, I wanted to ask Alan, you very briefly mentioned Michael's wife. I think her name was Maria Callejas.
Yes.
And he's a complex guy. I honestly found her to be even more like enigmatic and inscrutable. Honestly, she seems like a very unusual woman herself and kind of bounced all over the political spectrum, the violent political extremist spectrum, honestly. Can you talk about her just a little bit as well?
Yeah, she's fascinating also. And in fact, she is the reason that he will get in touch with Fatherland and Freedom, right, in like 71 or 72. She's 10 years older than him, right? And she is well-educated. She's actually fancied herself a writer, and she's written, you know, a few things, poems, that sort of thing, short stories. She's not particularly well-respected, but she's still young, and she's, you know, she's a decent writer. But, I mean, she's been married before. She's got two kids. She lived in Israel for a while. And so in some ways, she's sort of a leftist. You know, when she meets people who are on the right and they start spouting anti-Semitism, she'll defend the Jews. But she's also very anti-communist. And so when Allende comes to power, you know, she wants to get involved. And I think she sees her sort of literary fame tied up with her being sort of an agent of anti-Allende resistance. Right. They've even got this sort of Tokyo Rose type of radio programming, and she becomes the voice of this, right? It's called, I think it's called La Radio Liberacion. And they ride around this car in Santiago broadcasting this radio signal. And so she's the one who finds these Patria Libertad folks and says, you know, I might be able to help. I can write articles, I can do this and that, research writing. And I've got this husband who's American. And that's when their ears perk up and they go, oh, that's interesting. What does he do? And you go, well, he does bombs. And so they go, well, that's really interesting. And so she sort of uses Michael to get into this world. And it, you know, it pays off. They never become wealthy, but they're very, very poor at the beginning. And once the coup occurs, Dina essentially gives them a very small salary, but puts them in this beautiful big house in the hills of Santiago. So all of a sudden, they're living a life that they never imagined living. The price, of course, is that he's got to kill a lot of people. We really don't know how many, but he's sort of in charge of these big assassination plots. And in the basement of their house, there are people from Dina who are torturing folks. And so they have to kind of pretend that that's not happening there.
Before we go on, I want to let you all know about a new educational tool you're not going to want to miss. It's the Gray Man Briefing Classified. By now, I think I know my listeners pretty well, and take it from me, this briefing is exactly the news and educational reference source that you've been looking for. You'll get breaking news updates from all over the world on topics including planned protests and riots, low-intensity conflicts, natural disaster alerts, cyber attacks, supply chain disruptions, and more. You'll also get access to articles that help you build your own skills, including urban survival, home security, counter-surveillance, escape and evasion techniques, and more. And this is much more than just a newsletter in your inbox. Joining the Gray Man Briefing Classified also includes invitation-only channels on the Telegram and Signal apps for convenient real-time updates. The newsletter subscription is normally $5 per month, but if you use the code GBCSPYCRAFT, you can save 20% each month for the life of your subscription. I'm already a member myself and have been reading and learning a lot since I first subscribed. Look it up yourself at graymanbriefing.com. That's gray with an A, graymanbriefing.com. And use the discount code GBCSPYCRAFT to save 20% right from the start. Wow. So you can stay up on floors 2 and 3, but just don't go down to the basement.
Exactly. Yeah. And they're having two other kids. So there's 4 kids living with them.
My gosh. And so she is just completely on board with the violence all the way through that. Is that right? Does she participate in any way, or was she just okay with her husband?
She doesn't participate directly. I mean, I think it's rare that they would have a woman do that, in Dina, right? They're very macho. They use women as spies and so on. No, they don't have her do that directly. And she even basically, you know, eventually she sort of asked about this, like, why would you be part of an organization that does these terrible things? You seem like such an intellectual, you know, and such like a sophisticated person. And she basically tried to justify it in all sorts of ways by saying, well, they must have done something wrong if they're being tortured, right? These were terrible people. She preferred to sort of buy the justifications of the regime and just believe what she wanted to believe.
I see. So you mentioned we don't actually know how many people were targeted by Michael. I think that you mentioned, I want to say at least 4 or 5 separate events that he was tied to, or at least suspected of. I mean, he got around. Certainly.
Yes. I mean, you know, his victims are definitely not in the hundreds. I wouldn't even say in the dozens, but they're in, you know, the sort of maybe 5 to 20. You know, there have been new documents that have come out of this, but it's difficult to find out more. I mean, there's General Prats, who's killed in Argentina. There's Bernardo Leighton, there's an attempt to assassinate him in Rome, and he's with his wife. They both get harmed very seriously, but neither of them die. So both of these guys were sort of potential allies of Letelier, even though they weren't socialists. They were just sort of anti-Pinochet, you know, and they were political leaders living abroad. So they had sort of the same, they were targeted just like Letelier. So those are the ones we know really well. Now, one of the problems is that, and, you know, I'm sure we'll get into this, but Michael Townley eventually does spill the beans to the U.S. government. And part of his plea bargain deal is that the United States government will not try him on any other case except the Letelier-Moffitt case, and will not extradite him to any other country to force him to stand trial or even to testify. Now, he has testified, especially in sort of an Italian case, but the United States government is not making him do that.
Hmm. Okay. I see. Yeah, that was just a very, very confounding couple there, honestly. There's hardly anyone else out there like them in the world, I don't think.
Right.
So getting back to Letelier then, what was it specifically that marked him for death? Was it his ability to end that huge multimillion dollar deal, or was it just continued thorn in the side of the regime, or something else?
Yeah, I think it's both of those things, you know. You know, again, we can't tell exactly what Pinochet was thinking, but we do have a conversation of Pinochet and Kissinger in the summer of 76, right? So this is a few months before. And Pinochet, twice during the meeting, brings up the name of Letelier. He says, there's all these people in America and elsewhere abroad who are really a thorn in my side, and I wish you would do something about them, you know? And Kissinger basically says, well, it's not my job to do that, you know? But he also does not say, you know, do not target any Chileans in my country, right? Chileans in the United States. Mm-hmm. We would not look fondly on, you know, a foreign government killing people in our country. So he clearly is not saying that. And so Pinochet sort of, I think, is getting this green light signal that if you kill people like Letelier, we're not going to investigate very hard, right? Now, Kissinger should not be making that kind of insinuation, right? And, you know, he certainly doesn't promise outright, but, you know, he certainly doesn't control that kind of investigation. But I think Pinochet is getting the sense that if we kill, you know, if we go outside of the bounds of South America and start killing people in Rome and so on, we are so powerful abroad and we have such strong allies in these sort of Cold War governments that they're not going to oppose us. They're not going to intervene. They're not going to, you know, chase us down and investigate us. And I think that's sort of a limited thinking in how the Chileans think, is that the president in a democratic country controls all the parts of government all the time. Right. And that's simply not true. The United States government is very complex. A lot of people in that government are simply not under the control of somebody like even like Richard Nixon, right, who's a pretty sort of, you know, heavy handed president. He can't control everything. And so the Pinochet folks and Dina, really, they have this sense of impunity that doesn't conform to the reality.
I see. So this plan is to kill Letelier. How do they decide to go about it? Is it going to be similar to the hits in Rome and Argentina, or do they come up with something else entirely?
Yeah, well, you know, this one is, it's really sort of the most interesting one when it comes to Townley, because he's essentially asked to do it directly. Like others, he would sort of go to places like Italy and hire a shooter, right? Who would just sort of shoot someone. Now, in Argentina, it's a car bomb, you know? So they basically say, we've got a new job for you. And the man who tells him this, we do know, you know, from Townley, we know the conversation that this man has with Townley. The conversation takes place in the summer of 76, just as Pinochet is having these discussions with Kissinger. And the man's name is Espinosa. He's essentially the right-hand man of Contreras inside of DINA, right? He's the one who's actually going to give the order to the assassins to do, you know, to do an assassination. So he has this meeting with Townley, and it's almost comical, and so it's almost ludicrous in how sort of not thought through this is, or how they sort of compromise. So the very first thing that Espinosa tells Townley is, I'd like you to take out, right, an enemy of the regime in Washington. His name is Orlando Letelier. Townley has no idea who this guy is, right? He's not that keen on all the politics, but he says, all right, you know, another job. Like, he's a little bit impatient about this. He doesn't love doing this work. And Espinosa says, yes. So we need you to follow him, track his movements, and then kill him quietly, right? We don't want this to raise a big ruckus. So don't kill anybody else, right? Don't make a big noise. And so those are essentially the conditions. And Townley says, well, I make bombs, right? I'm a bomb maker. So if you're asking me to kill someone, the only way that I kill people is with bombs. And Espinosa says, we'd really prefer something quiet, like a mugging, right? Or just go slit his throat in the streets or hire somebody to just mug him, make it look like he resisted a mugging and got killed. But the exiles will figure out what this means. And Townley says, no, I don't do that. I'm not a really violent person.
Oh, my God.
It's really an absurd conversation. He goes, how about the car bomb? And Espinosa finally gives up and says, whatever, just kill him, you know? Just take care of it. And then it gets even more complicated, because Townley starts putting together the elements of, you know, starts surveilling him and goes to Chile with a couple, I'm sorry, goes to the United States with a couple of Chileans. And then he teams up with about a half dozen Cubans. I think it's really complicated. These are Cuban Americans who left Cuba usually because of Fidel Castro. So they're very anti-Castro. They're very anti-communist. A lot of them have been trained with the CIA. Some of them did the Bay of Pigs. There's a botched invasion of Cuba in 61. They've all been trained in things like explosives and terrorism. And they are interested in helping in this assassination, not because they particularly care about Letelier or Chile, right? They are sort of in competition with other Cuban-American right-wing terrorist organizations who are sort of anti-Castro. And the way that you sort of distinguish yourself in that hierarchy of dozens of organizations is by allying with the big man of anti-communism in Latin America, which is Augusto Pinochet, right? They can do a job for Pinochet. And if the others can sort of know that it was them, this little organization that's actually based in New Jersey, then they will increase their status, right? They'll just be more important. So they agree to help in this assassination without even asking for money. They're not offered any, but they also don't ask for any money.
So this is like a status thing for them.
It's a status thing for them completely. It's the odd. I mean, later on, when the FBI is on their tail, they're going to ask for money, and the Chileans will say, absolutely not. But so then it gets more complicated, because these sort of half dozen, right, guys, they put together a bomb, and it's very rudimentary. It's like in the tin of a cake pan. They tape it to the bottom of the car of Letelier. And then the bomber, Michael Townley, tells the Cubans, I'll put it in the car, on the car, but you guys have to detonate it. And they go, no way. You need to be in this job yourself. You need to detonate the bomb. And he goes, no, it's better if I leave the country like a day before the assassination. That way there's no Chileans who are tied to this. And the Cubans say, no, absolutely not. So the Cubans are making it even harder, right, for DINA to get some distance from this. Hmm. And they put the bomb under the car. And as far as I know, Townley follows the car the next day. And Letelier is the only person in the car, but the bomb does not work. Right, the radio control button doesn't detonate the bomb. And so they have to go back under the car a second night in the middle of the night And that time it's the Cubans who do it. And then they follow the car the next day. And it turns out that that's September 21st, 1976. And just by coincidence, Letelier has two young Americans in the car with him. And so the Cubans don't care about this. They don't know about the conversation with Espinosa. They don't know that you're not supposed to kill other people. They don't care. And so they detonate the bomb and they kill Letelier. They kill Ronnie Moffitt, a 25-year-old American woman. And they hurt, but not very seriously, the husband who was sitting in the backseat.
Yeah, that was unbelievable. Just what a, I hate to use the word comedy, but just a comedy of errors leading up to the actual detonation. I'm surprised that they pulled it off at all. But yeah, it just seems like it was so many mistakes made by these guys, even with the level of experience that they all had in various parts of the world by that point.
Yeah, so, I mean, one of my quotes in my book is that this is one of the stupidest assassinations ever done. And it's not just stupid in sort of the execution of it. I mean, it's also evil. And I mean, we can't forget how terrible this is. I mean, physically, it's a really terrible thing. If you sort of, you'll see the details in the first chapter, and it's quite horrifying. But just the execution is stupid, but also the politics behind it. They really didn't think about what the consequences of this might be. They just sort of figured, we'll instill fear, and then that'll be it. Nobody will ever trace this back to us. But it was so obvious that it was them.
Yeah, just it's a real head scratcher, certainly. And like I looked at the map the other day, Sheridan Circle right there, it's full of embassies. I mean, the idea of a car bomb exploding right outside of multiple foreign embassies, like how could you shine a bigger spotlight on your activities than that, of all places? Not even, in the driveway of his home or something like that, but right there of all places, just a terribly ill-conceived plan, it seems.
Exactly. And I mean, I'm it's still not clear to me that that's where Townley would have done it. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, most of the way that Letelier took to get to IPS was along Embassy Row. So it's likely that it would have been close to some embassy. But I mean, it was a traffic circle. It's essentially all embassies around there. And, coincidentally, just off the circle, about two houses off the circle, is the Chilean ambassador's residence, the very house where Letelier himself lived. Right. So 3 years before he gets killed there. Mm-hmm. And so they really are not thinking about these things. I think if it was Townley, he probably would have detonated the bomb somewhere in the suburbs, maybe around a park or something like that, where maybe there wouldn't have been other folks. But yeah, this was close to the White House, very close to the State Department. And so brought up, this is clearly front page news for weeks.
Right, right. Yeah, just boggles the mind, honestly. So because of all these mistakes that were made, did this lead the investigators pretty quickly to all of the perpetrators, or was it still like a tough case for them to crack?
It was still a very tough case. I mean, for all sorts of reasons. One is that there are actually few people inside the U.S. government who believed that this has to be Pinochet, right? And has to be Dina. Even though right after the bombing happens and Michael Moffitt, who is the husband of Ronnie Moffitt, is in the street screaming at the ambassador's house saying, you did this, Dina did this. And this is what he tells the U.S. government immediately, right? It can only be them. Still, we have several memos from inside the U.S. government and even major newspapers who are basically saying, Pinochet wouldn't do this. He's not stupid enough to do something like this because he'd be the first one to be blamed, right? Mm-hmm. So it's probably extreme leftists, right? Because there are sort of, extreme guerrilla groups in Chile. There's probably these militants who put a bomb in there and they want to blame Pinochet and Dina. But there's no evidence of this whatsoever. So the job of sort of finding out the facts falls to the Department of Justice, an assistant U.S. attorney called Gene Proper. And he heads a team of about four or five guys, right? There's like an FBI guy. It's mostly FBI folks. And the FBI, of course, is within the Department of Justice. And he reports back to the attorney general. And essentially, it's very difficult because they figure out pretty quickly, this is probably Chile. But how to, get any sort of evidence of this is going to be very difficult. They ask the CIA, right? Because the CIA obviously spies abroad. The FBI spies at home. So the CIA would have information, and has friends, obviously, in the Chilean government. And the CIA, and this is George H.W. Bush's CIA when he was director back in the 70s, they basically are mum on this question. They're not giving them any evidence at all to the FBI. In fact, they call up some journalists and they place an item in Newsweek that basically says that the FBI has decided that this is not Pinochet, right?
Oh, wow.
So the CIA is sort of actively trying to discourage this. And, you know, this speaks to the different sort of visions in the U.S. government. Some of them are glad that he's dead. You know, they think it maybe this hasn't been done in the right way, maybe a little too public, but they're glad that this socialist is dead. He's a socialist, so, you know, who really cares? It's a point, you know, for the good guys in the Cold War. But more importantly for the CIA, they don't want to ruffle any feathers. They don't want to lose any contacts or burn any bridges in Chile, right? It's one of the most important regimes for them in South America. They want to stay friendly with it. And the FBI, even at some point, doesn't want to share information with the CIA because they say, if we tell the CIA, they will tell the guys who did this, right, down in South America, and then we completely lose our case. And so there's not even cooperation in Washington on this. So the FBI is sort of on its own. It can, you know, it's got some help from the embassy, especially by the Ford presidency and especially by the Carter presidency, right? So this is 76. It's like 6 weeks before the election. And then Carter and the Democrats are in power by early 77. And they are much more, you know, happy to sort of embrace human rights as a major cause of U.S. diplomacy. And so they're much more ready to put pressure on Pinochet to sort of help them with the investigation. And Pinochet, of course, his line is that, hey, this is a crime that happened in the United States. There's no proof it originated in Chile, and therefore we'll help you as much as we can, but why would you blame us, right?
Right, right. I see.
So, you know, so they follow all of these leads. There's something like at some point, 75 agents who are on top of this. It's a major priority for the FBI and Department of Justice, but they follow all these leads that lead nowhere. But eventually they've got eventually two theories. So it's either Dina, who somehow sent some Chileans here and we can't find them, or it's Cuban Americans who did this. But at some point they start tying these two things together. At some point, there's a girlfriend of one of the FBI investigators who gets threatened. I think she's at LaGuardia Airport. She's a stewardess. And she gets threatened by a Cuban American. And the Cuban American basically says, tell your boyfriend to sort of leave this Chile coup, this Chile assassination alone, or else we'll kill you and we'll kill him. And she's terrified and so on. But, you know, the proper and his team saying, why would the Cubans threaten us with leaving an investigation of Chile alone if they're not tied to it, right? So they start putting this all together. So there's all sorts of clues like that, but it takes a year and a half from late 76 to early 78 to finally get the name of Michael Townley out there. And this itself is a fascinating story. They have a photograph of Michael Townley and a Chilean called Armando Fernandez, because these two guys applied for visas to come to the United States. The visas were denied, but somehow the embassy held on to two photographs, but separated the photographs from the applications and then misplaced the applications. But somehow they know that these two guys came to the United States. And they also have fake names, right, for these two men. So they publish the fake names in Chile and they come up as fake, right? Nobody can find them. And then they go, okay, there's one more thing we can do, which is take these photographs and put them in newspaper and say, does anybody know who this is, right? Because we suspect that they're tied to the Letelier assassination. So they essentially give it to a newspaper that doesn't exist anymore, the Washington Star. The Star puts it in their paper. The very next day, it's in all the Chilean papers. Right? Who are these two men? You know, the Americans think that they're Chileans. And within something like 24 hours, Chileans are writing back to the United States saying, oh, this is Michael Townley, right? He's a well-known bomb maker, works for Dina, so on. And they identify the other guy. He's a military man. And that's when the FBI finally has their man. And to them, they're amazed that this is an American, right? And what that means to them is that they can put pressure on Chile to give them back their citizen. They can say, okay, you need to give this man to us because he belongs to us, right? We have the right. You cannot keep them in your country. He's an American citizen. And it allows the Chileans to say, well, then this is a crime committed by a foreigner in a foreign country. And therefore, the Chilean government has nothing to do with this, right? Mm-hmm. This is just a bomber who went to Washington and killed a Chilean. It's not our problem. And so Townley gets expelled by Chile, but once he's in the United States, he essentially you know, the FBI basically starts playing bad cop with him and threatening him with all sorts of things. He realizes he's in trouble. He's been abandoned by Chile. And so he plea bargains and tells the entire story from, you know, from the time he was a child to the time he set off the bomb. And it's a really fascinating tale. And it's never really been contradicted by any other source. So as far as we know, everything he said has been very accurate.
That was certainly a huge boon for your book, I could tell, because of everything that he gave up. And it's incredible to have the whole story from the from the perpetrator himself after all these years. Certainly.
Yeah.
So did he ultimately, I guess he did some time in prison, didn't he?
He did some time, something like 3 or 4 years, right? Good behavior, so on. I mean, he's a very sort of peaceful, quiet guy, right? Apart from the assassinations. So he's not the sort of guy who's going to fight in prison. So he got out relatively early, but it was 3 or 4 years, and then went into witness protection, right? And so my assumption is that he is still alive. I think if he died, we would find out. But ever since the early 80s, maybe 83, he has been living somewhere, I assume, in the United States. Every once in a while, he pops up to either testify in a case in Europe or he gives an interview. At this point, he's got to be maybe 70 years old. And so, you know, he might have died, or if not, he will probably die fairly soon. So we don't know anything about him, right? He doesn't talk about his personal life. And, you know, he's a private citizen living under clearly an assumed name and protected by the U.S. government. And that was part of the plea bargain. That was part of the conditions of him telling the entire story. Yeah, we don't know anything more about him.
Amazing. That was something that I wanted to ask you about, because just a quick search shows that he has clearly done some like videotaped interviews in the past, you know, many years ago. But I was wondering, how does a person in witness protection end up giving filmed interview? Like, why would they do that? Kind of defeats the whole purpose. So do you happen to know, was he like contacting news agencies to get his side of the story out there or something like that?
Was it government producing him? Yeah, I'm not sure how it happens. I mean, I once asked somebody, you know, in the know, like, would I be able to get in touch with Michael Townley? And they said, you can ask the federal marshal's office to let you talk to him. So I think that's how you put in a request. And maybe he sees those requests. Maybe he answers some of them. You know, when I did my book, he hadn't talked in years and years and years. And I figured there's no way he's going to want to talk to me. And you know, frankly, I'm not sure there was anything left for him to say. You know, if he testifies for a different case, that's different. But on this case, I mean, he basically said everything he's ever going to say. And rarely is he interviewed about the Letelier killing. But every once in a while, a Chilean will somehow get in touch with him. So maybe he's got a few friends in Chile. But I think he then goes back to his assumed identity and is able to hide out wherever he is.
Okay. Yeah, very interesting. I wouldn't know how to do that. But it kind of makes sense to me that somebody who's been sort of living with the consequences of an event in their past all this time, they kind of revisit it one way or the other. Maybe they want to get it out, you know, every once in a while, at least every few years, they're willing to open up a little bit about it. That, you know, might be worthwhile. I mean, it's been worthwhile for someone at least to reach out.
Right. I mean, the conditions of his, you know, of his detention, if you want, his secrecy, you know, are not that he remains secret. He can talk about anything he wants. He just can't have the U.S. government can't force him to talk about any other cases. And can't prosecute him for any other cases except the Letelier case.
Okay, I see. So the other guys, also the Cubans, they all were arrested and tried and imprisoned to varying degrees, right? Or varying sentences anyway, weren't they?
Yes, that's another odd story of a very incompetent judicial system, especially when it came to right-wing Cuban Americans. I mean, you have to put this in context that, you know, there are hundreds of thousands of right-wing Cuban Americans, mostly in Miami, but a lot of them in the New York, New Jersey area. And hundreds, if not thousands of them, engage in terrorist activities in the mid-1970s. And so they have also had an evolution, right? In the early 60s, they essentially were working for the U.S. government. They were working for the CIA, trained by the CIA by the thousands in the Miami area to essentially invade Cuba. But then when that invasion doesn't happen and the Cuban Missile Crisis happens, right, the U.S. government basically says, okay, we're no longer in the Cuba invading business. So we're firing all of these Cuban Americans. So go off and you live your life in America. You're free, but we're not going to pay you anymore. We're not going to train you. Then they get very angry at Washington, D.C. And partly out of revenge, but also partly because they just don't have the money, the training anymore to sort of try to invade Cuba. They start attacking friends of Fidel Castro, representatives of Fidel Castro outside of Cuba. So it's a little bit like Operation Condor, right? So there's sort of a natural harmony between these two essentially terrorist organizations. And so they start bombing the United Nations in New York, for instance, right? If, let's say, a theater, a movie theater in New York wants to show like a Cuban movie, they will call in a bomb threat. So they'll do that sort of thing to really harass Cuba as much as possible. And so when they see this opportunity come up to kill Letelier, right, that's a no-brainer for them. So yes, they're involved. The FBI sort of identifies them all. The trick about them, though, the way they're very different from Townley is that they're much more loyal to the Cuba cause. They get dragged in front of a grand jury. Not one of them talks, right? Or at least they don't say the things the FBI wants them to say. They are tried. A few of them go to prison, but then they get off on technicalities. A few of them are actually on the lam until 1990. And then finally, the FBI tracks them. And interestingly, one of them appears on America's Most Wanted, which was a very popular TV show back then that would sort of profile these criminals. And that's how somebody realizes, hey, that's my neighbor, right, in Miami. And so they call the FBI and they go, because I mean, tens of millions of people would watch that show. It's very popular. And so one of the guys gets caught by being on America's Most Wanted. And though those guys who caught in 1990, they spend the most time in prison. I think it's something like 7 years. But the other three, they spend a few months, maybe a year. It's really not much time.
Yeah, I think that a couple of the convictions were overturned on technicalities and retried, and then they were acquitted in the second trial, weren't they?
Yeah, I mean, I remember one case. I can't remember which of the Cubans it is, but he essentially gets tried and sent to prison because he boasted of the Letelier case while he was in prison on another charge to another prisoner. And so the prosecution team finds this other prisoner and says, okay, we have a witness here who got a confession from this guy, like a prison confession. It wasn't coerced or anything like that. He just, you know, he bragged. But it turned out that prison confessions were not admissible, or maybe a law was passed that made them inadmissible. And so they, you know, they dragged this case in front of another judge. And then the judge basically says, yeah, you know, this is not admissible evidence, and therefore he's free. Even though there's plenty of other evidence that would have made the case. I mean, it's sort of a travesty of justice how these guys get off so easily, right? And even today, I mean, these guys are still, you know, they're well known. You could probably find them relatively easily. I know a historian who knew them all 5-10 years ago. He took photos with them. And so they're well-known characters in sort of the Cuban areas of Miami, and they're seen as freedom fighters, right? They're seen as sort of anti-communist heroes who tried to free Cuba several times and kill Cuba's enemies. And one of them was Letelier. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a couple of years ago, I went to the 60th anniversary of the Bay of Pigs invasion. They had a memorial in Miami at the airport there for all of the surviving members of the brigade.
Right.
And I would not be surprised at all if a couple of the guys that were involved in this were there, because all of the, you know, these guys basically were there. I mean, hundreds of these guys. I met some veterans of the Operation Mongoose, which, you know, was attacks on Cuban shipping that took place right after Bay of Pigs. And, you know, everybody there, nobody there felt any sense of shame for anything that they did to fight communism and the Cuban government and Fidel Castro at any point. They were very, very riled up even now in 2021 when I was down there. It was quite amazing to see.
Oh yeah, I mean I wrote an article on this, and there's a lot in the book on this, and that they live in this sort of society, for lack of a better term, where this sort of violence is encouraged, right? You can call it terrorism or just militancy, but violence and actions against Cuba are encouraged and rewarded. So, for instance, these guys had to go to court. They had hefty court bills, right? They had to pay lawyers, and then these Cuban American business people would get together and, you know, help them pay for their bills. They would organize telethons or radiothons to sort of drum up hundreds of thousands of dollars among Cuban Americans. I mean, there was a lot of sort of open sympathy with these folks, and it paid off because, you know, you can commit this crime and you will have 500,000 people backing you in the commission of this crime. Mm-hmm. And so they feel no loyalty whatsoever to the U.S. government, even though the U.S. government has taken them in. right, has taken them in as political refugees from a communist revolution, and they turn their backs on it so easily as soon as that government is not backing a violent overthrow of their own country.
Yeah, incredible stuff. There's really nothing else like it that I can think of here in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, I have the statistic in the book that in 1974, I think it's 45% of all bombing, of all terrorist bombings on the planet were connected to Cuban Americans. 45% of the whole planet. I mean, and this is hundreds of bombings, right?
Man, I did not realize it was that high at all.
Yeah.
So we've talked about the fallout for the individuals who were involved, but what about for like U.S. and Chilean relations and for the Pinochet government as a whole? I mean, did this really hurt his government, this bombing?
Yes. I mean, it happens progressively because, first of all, you know, it takes years just to resolve it, just to find Michael Townley. But once that happens, then this, you know, the FBI says, okay, it was always the Chileans. Now we know. And so the next thing that we want, apart from maybe getting some Cubans, is to get Santiago to extradite the men who are guilty on this. So one is that Chilean, Armando Fernandez, who actually came to the United States. And then they also want Espinosa, who gave the order, and they want Contreras, who gave the order to Espinosa to give the order, right? They know these are the guys making the decisions. Obviously, they think Pinochet might be involved in this, but they, you know, they can't really prove that. And Michael Townley can't prove that. He doesn't talk to Pinochet. So they want the U.S., they want the Chilean government to cooperate in handing these people over, or if not, trying them. And that's a real dilemma that they have, because they say, you know, we'd have to put so much pressure on them to hand these men over, their own citizens over, that it's almost legally impossible to do that. But if we trust them when they say they're going to give these men a fair trial and a serious trial, then we're leaving it in their hands. And that's essentially what they decide to do. Mm-hmm. They leave it in the hands of a regime that on paper has an independent judiciary, but in fact does not, right? A lot of crimes that are essentially crimes against civilians are tried in military courts. All of the judges have been named by Pinochet. Many of the judges themselves were involved in the commission of crimes early in the regime, or at least looked the other way in the commission of many crimes. And so everybody is in the soup. And so essentially almost nobody wants to help Pinochet. And it's almost sort of a legal miracle, and this is most of the sort of last third of the book, is for the families of Letelier and Moffitt to try to keep this case alive. Just keep it alive. And it's really, there's about a few days left in the statute of limitations in 1991, when Pinochet has just left office. And a few new judges, right, by the democratic regime have been not named, appointed, and therefore the case is able to move towards an indictment and finally have an indictment against, right, the top dogs. And then it takes until 1995 for the Supreme Court to find in favor of a lower court that has essentially committed these men to prison in Chile. So it's in 1995 that they go to prison for a crime they committed in 1976.
Wow, almost 20 years. Okay, and this is Contreras that went to prison and a few others, is that correct?
This is Contreras and Espinosa. Okay. The lower ranked person, Fernandez, actually, this is another interesting story. He defects in late 1980s, I think it was 87, where he feels so guilty, right? He's never been able to move on from this. He's been sort of protected by the military, like paid by the military, but also doesn't have a military job. So he's got sort of nothing to do. And he becomes very depressed. And he basically says, my father would have been ashamed of me. I need to go to the United States and fess up that I did this. And hopefully they'll forgive me, right? Like they've sort of more or less forgotten Michael Townley. Like this guy didn't do what Townley did. He didn't put a bomb in a car. He just sort of followed Townley around as part of the assassination plot. And so it's a very complicated story, but he finds a few American diplomats. It's all very cloak and dagger. They're sort of hiding him. I think they fly him through Brazil because you're not allowed to fly to the United States from Chile if you're in the Chilean government, because they know that people are going to defect. So he flies to Brazil and eventually gives himself up in the United States under the sort of supervision of the of the Department of State. And he ends up living in Miami, might still be alive as far as I can tell, although he's been persecuted in a few other things that he's done that lasted. You know, these cases came back in the 1990s and the early 2000s. But I mean, he stayed very, very low profile, but not in the witness protection program.
Okay. So justice was served to a certain extent in the long run here.
Yes. So Contreras and Espinosa, they get, they're found guilty. It's really sort of touch and go as to whether they're actually going to go to jail for several months. As you know, Contreras is basically saying, I'm not going to any kind of jail. This is all a lie. The CIA did it, right? That's his line the whole time, is that the CIA did this. Michael Townley worked for the CIA. Chilean government had nothing to do with this. In fact, the Chilean government builds a luxury prison just for those two men, right? Eventually, more sort of former Pinochet folks will be in that prison, but they build it at the cost of, you know, many millions of dollars just for these two men to be comfortable, and so that the rest of the military doesn't rise up against this sort of new democracy, right? Because that's the danger. If you target this one military man who's beloved by many, others will think that you're going to target them next. And in fact, that's actually kind of what happens, because this case is the only one that can be tried for a long time. And therefore, these two men are the first Chileans who go to jail for violations of human rights during the Cold War. And in fact, they may be the first Latin Americans who go to jail for violations of human rights during the Cold War. So this case is really important for setting that precedent of sort of transitioning, of transitional justice, as we call it, transitioning from dictatorships to democracy and making the violators of human rights pay a price for what they did.
My goodness. So, Alan, do you think that the Pinochet government, does the shadow of that still kind of loom over Chile even now, or is the country mostly moved on from that dark period?
I mean, I think it's moved on from violations of human rights and this sort of rabid anti-communism. The end of the Cold War took care of a lot of this, but there's a lot of people who are still pro-Pinochet. They still believe that Pinochet was a hero for freeing the nation from this sort of godless communism, right? They still are very divided on who was the best president, right? Allende or Pinochet. But in a larger sense, there's still, I mean, you know, if you follow Chile for the last 5 years or so, right, they went, it was very tumultuous. And you had a huge sort of very youth-driven movement that was against the constitution that Pinochet imposed on the nation during his dictatorship, and it is still there. The problem is that, you know, Pinochet didn't just sort of violate human rights. He also transformed the economy and made it very, very privatized, right? He used the famous Chicago Boys, or these Chilean economists trained at the University of Chicago, to not only sort of end socialism, but to really transform Chile into a highly privatized, highly unequal society. And it has remained so to this day. And, you know, if you're going through education or healthcare, I mean, these things are very, very expensive for the poor. And there's so much wealth inequality in Chile, even though it's a very prosperous and democratic country. And so that's fundamentally what the youth, and I would say even the current sort of left-wing government, is trying to change in Chile. And that's what the very wealthy and the right wing are trying to resist, is any kind of change that would make Chile more equal. And this harkens back to Letelier, because his fundamental thesis about Chilean society is that Pinochet exists because Chile is so unequal, right? In order to sustain this level of inequality, you need to have a strong man at the helm who's sort of shutting down any kind of resistance to that inequality. So it's not out of the question that Chile eventually might revert to another strong man to sort of keep that inequality, that social, economic, political inequality going in what is still a very divided country. I'm hoping that's not going to happen, but it's possible.
I see. Amazing how these things turn out to be kind of cyclical sometimes. You know, what was old is new again.
That's true.
Wow. Okay, well, this is an incredible story, Alan. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed your book. For those of you who want to pick it up, it is called Ghosts of Sheridan Circle by Dr. Alan McPherson. Alan, are you working on another book right now?
I am. It's essentially over. I'm about to sign a contract for its publication. It is about Iran-Contra. And it's sort of connected to Latin America. And it's about how Iran-Contra constituted an assault on American democracy. So it will be out before the 40th anniversary of that in 1980s scandal. And hopefully it'll prompt some debates and discussion, and people will get to know this scandal that was very complicated, but really interesting.
Yeah, it certainly is. I've covered it to a certain extent here on the podcast before, but, you know, incredibly complex and big and story with huge repercussions all over. So I'll definitely look for the book when it comes out. Do you think it'll be out like later this year or 2025, something like that?
Early 2025, spring 2025.
Great, great. Okay, well, I'll definitely look out for it then. Well, thank you so much, Alan. This has been really informative. Do you have any like social media pages or website or anything if people want to connect with you after they listen to this episode?
I'm not big on social media, but I am on X. People can always reach me that way. Okay. They can find my email by going to my webpage at Temple University where I teach. So yeah.
Fantastic. All right. Well, thank you. This has been a great talk. I really appreciate it, Alan. Take care.
Thank you.
If you're interested in more of Spycraft 101, look for my page on Instagram at Spycraft101. You can also find more great articles on my website, spycraft101.com. Thank you all for listening, and I hope you'll stick around because there is lots more to come.
Disclaimer. This podcast is for entertainment purposes only. The stories and statements expressed herein are experiences and opinions. They may not reflect the views of the host or the production studio. It's okay if you disagree with our content. No piece of media is right for everyone. If you love Spycraft 101, please check us out online, on Instagram, on YouTube, and especially on Patreon. Thank you for listening.